Chapter 4. An Overview of Prices. We need education in the obvious more than investigation of the obscure. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Many of the basic principles of economics may seem obvious, but the implications to be drawn from them are not, and it is the implications that matter. Someone once pointed out that Newton was not the first man who saw an apple fall. His fame was based on his being the first to understand its implications. Economists have understood for centuries that when prices are higher, people tend to buy less than when prices are lower. But even today, many people do not yet understand the many implications of that simple fact. For example, one consequence of not thinking through the implications of this simple fact is that government-provided medical care has repeatedly cost far more than initially estimated in various countries around the world. These estimates have usually been based on current usage of doctors, hospitals, and pharmaceutical drugs. But the introduction of free or subsidized medical care leads to vastly greater usage, simply because its price is lower, and this entails vastly greater costs than initially estimated. Understanding any subject requires that it first be defined, so that you are clear in your own mind as to what you are talking about and what you are not talking about. Just as a poetic discussion of the weather is not meteorology, so an issuance of moral pronouncements or political creeds about the economy is not economics. Economics is an analysis of cause and effect relationships in an economy. Its purpose is to discern the consequences of various ways of allocating scarce resources which have alternative uses. It has nothing to say about social philosophy or moral values, any more than it has anything to say about humor or anger. These other things are not necessarily any less important. They are simply not what economics is about. No one expects mathematics to explain love, and no one should expect economics to be something other than what it is, or to do something other than what it can. But both mathematics and economics can be very important where they apply. Careful and complex mathematical calculations can be the difference between having an astronaut who is returning to Earth from orbit end up crashing in the Himalayas or landing safely in Florida. We have also seen similar social disasters from misunderstanding the basic principles of economics. Cause and effect. Analyzing economic actions in cause and effect terms means examining the logic of the incentives being created, rather than simply thinking about the desirability of the goals being sought. It also means examining the empirical evidence of what actually happens under such incentives. The kind of causation at work in an economy is often systemic interactions, rather than the kind of simple one-way causation involved when one billiard ball hits another billiard ball and knocks it into a pocket. Systemic causation involves more complex reciprocal interactions, such as adding lye to hydrochloric acid and ending up with salty water, because both chemicals are transformed by their effects on one another, going from being two deadly substances to becoming one harmless one. In an economy as well, the plans of buyers and sellers are transformed as they discover each other's reactions to supply and demand conditions, and the resulting price changes that force them to reassess their plans. Just as those who start out planning to buy a villa at the beach may end up settling for a bungalow farther inland after they discover the high prices of villas at the beach, suppliers likewise sometimes end up selling their goods for less than they paid to buy them or produce them, when the demand is inadequate to get any higher price from the consuming public, and the alternative is to get nothing at all for an item that is unsaleable at the price originally planned. Systemic causation. Because systemic causation involves reciprocal interactions rather than one-way causation, that reduces the role of individual intentions. As Friedrich Engels put it, what each individual wills is obstructed by everyone else, and what emerges is something that no one willed. Economics is concerned with what emerges, not what anyone intended. If the stock market closes at 14,367 on a given day, that is the end result of a process of complex interactions among innumerable buyers and sellers of stocks, none of whom may have intended for the market to close at 14,367, even though it was their own actions in pursuit of other intentions which caused it to do so. While causation can sometimes be explained by intentional actions, and sometimes by systemic interactions, too often the results of systemic interactions are falsely explained by individual intentions. Just as primitive peoples tended to attribute such things as the swaying of trees in the wind to some intentional action by an invisible spirit, rather than to such systemic causes as variations in atmospheric pressure, so there is a tendency toward intentional explanations of systemic events in the economy when people are unaware of basic economic principles. For example, while rising prices are likely to reflect changes in supply and demand, people ignorant of economics may attribute price rises to greed. People shocked by the high prices charged in stores in low-income neighborhoods have often been quick to blame greed or exploitation on the part of the people who run such businesses. Similar conclusions about intentions have often been reached when people noticed the much higher interest rates charged by pawnbrokers and small finance companies that operate in low-income neighborhoods, as compared to the interest rates charged by banks in middle-class communities. Companies that charge for cashing checks also usually operate in low-income neighborhoods, while people in middle-class neighborhoods usually get their checks cashed free of charge at their local banks. Yet profit rates are generally no higher in inner-city businesses than elsewhere, and the fact that many businesses are leaving such neighborhoods, and others, such as supermarket chains, are staying away, reinforces that conclusion. The painful fact that poor people end up paying more than affluent people for many goods and services has a very plain and systemic explanation. It often costs more to deliver goods and services in low-income neighborhoods. Higher insurance costs and higher costs for various security precautions due to higher rates of crime and vandalism are just some of the systemic reasons that get ignored by those seeking an explanation in terms of personal intentions. In addition, the cost of doing business tends to be higher per dollar of business in low-income neighborhoods. Lending $100 each to 50 low-income borrowers at pawn shops or local finance companies takes more time and costs more money to process the transactions than lending $5,000 at a bank to one middle-class customer, even though the same total sum of money is involved in both cases. About 10% of American families do not have a checking account, and undoubtedly this percentage is higher among low-income families, so that many of them resort to local check-cashing agencies to cash their paychecks, Social Security checks, or other checks. An armored car delivering money in small denominations to a neighborhood finance company or a small check-cashing agency in a ghetto costs just as much as an armored car delivering 100 times as much value of money in larger denominations of bills to a bank in a suburban shopping mall. With the cost of doing business being higher per dollar of business in the low-income community, it is hardly surprising that these higher costs get passed on in higher prices and higher interest rates. Higher prices for people who can least afford them are a tragic end result, but the causes are systemic. This is not merely a philosophic or semantic distinction. There are major practical consequences to the way causation is understood. Treating the causes of higher prices and higher interest rates in low-income neighborhoods as being personal greed or exploitation, and trying to remedy it by imposing price controls and interest rate ceilings, only ensures that even less will be supplied to people living in low-income neighborhoods thereafter. Just as rent control reduces the supply of housing, so price controls and interest rate controls can reduce the number of stores, pawn shops, local finance companies, and check-cashing agencies willing to operate in neighborhoods with higher costs when those costs cannot be recovered by legally permissible prices and interest rates. The alternative for many residents of low-income neighborhoods may be to go outside the legal money-lending organizations and borrow from loan sharks, who charge even higher rates of interest and have their own methods of collecting, such as physical violence. When stores and financial institutions close down in low-income neighborhoods, more people in such neighborhoods are then forced to travel to other neighborhoods to shop for groceries or other goods, paying money for bus fare or taxi fare, in addition to the costs of their purchases. Such business closings have already occurred for a variety of reasons, including riots and higher rates of shoplifting and vandalism, with the net result that many people in low-income neighborhoods already have to go elsewhere for shopping or banking. First, do no harm is a principle that has endured for centuries. Understanding the distinction between systemic causation and intentional causation is one way to do less harm with economic policies. It is especially important to do no harm to people who are already in painful economic circumstances. It is also worth noting that most people are not criminals, even in high-crime neighborhoods. The fraction of dishonest people in such neighborhoods are the real source of many of the higher costs behind the higher prices charged by businesses operating in those neighborhoods. But it is both intellectually and emotionally easier to blame high prices on those who collect them, rather than on those who cause them. It is also more politically popular to blame outsiders, especially if those outsiders are of a different ethnic background. Systemic causes, such as those often found in economics, provide no such emotional release for the public or moral melodrama for the media and politicians, as such intentional causes as greed, exploitation, gouging, discrimination, and the like. Intentional explanations of cause and effect may also be more natural, in the sense that less sophisticated individuals and less sophisticated societies tend to turn first to such explanations. In some cases, it has taken centuries for intentional explanations embodied in superstitions about nature to give way to systemic explanations based on science. It is not yet clear whether it will take that long for the basic principles of economics to replace many people's natural tendency to try to explain systemic results by intentional causes. Complexity and causation. Although the basic principles of economics are not really complicated, the very ease with which they can be learned also makes them easy to dismiss as simplistic by those who do not want to accept analyses which contradict some of their cherished beliefs. Evasions of the obvious are often far more complicated than the plain facts, nor is it automatically true that complex effects must have complex causes. The ramifications of something very simple can become enormously complex. For example, the simple fact that the Earth is tilted on its axis causes innumerable very complex reactions in plants, animals, and people, as well as in such non-living things as ocean currents, weather changes, and changes in the length of night and day. If the Earth stood straight up on its axis, night and day would be the same length all year round and in all parts of the world. Climate would still differ between the equator and the poles, but at any given place, the climate would be the same in winter as in summer. The fact that the Earth is tilted on its axis means that sunlight is striking the same country at different angles at different points during the planet's annual orbit around the sun, leading to changing warmth and changing lengths of night and day. In turn, such changes trigger complex biological reactions in plant growth, animal hibernations and migrations, as well as psychological changes in human beings and many seasonal changes in their economies. Changing weather patterns affect ocean currents at the frequency of hurricanes, among many other natural phenomena. Yet all of these complications are due to the one simple fact that the Earth is tilted on its axis instead of being straight up. In short, complex effects may be a result of either simple causes or complex causes. The specific facts can tell us which. A priori pronouncements about what is simplistic cannot. An explanation is too simple if its conclusions fail to match the facts or its reasoning violates logic. But calling an explanation simplistic is too often a substitute for examining either its evidence or its logic. Few things are more simple than the fact that people tend to buy more at lower prices and buy less at higher prices. But when putting that together with the fact that producers tend to supply more at higher prices and less at lower prices, that is enough to predict many sorts of complex reactions to price controls, whether in the housing market or in the market for food, electricity, or medical care. Moreover, these reactions have been found on all inhabited continents and over thousands of years of recorded history. Simple causes and complex effects have been common among wide varieties of peoples and cultures. Individual rationality versus systemic rationality. The tendency to personalize causation leads not only to charges that greed causes high prices in market economies, but also to charges that stupidity among bureaucrats is responsible for many things that go wrong in government economic activities. In reality, Many of the things that go wrong in these activities are due to perfectly rational actions, given the incentives faced by government officials who run such activities, and given the inherent constraints on the amount of knowledge available to any given decision-maker or set of decision-makers. Where a policy or institution has been established by top political leaders, officials subject to their authority may well hesitate to contradict their beliefs, much less point out the counterproductive consequences that later follow from these policies and institutions. Messengers carrying bad news could be risking their careers, or, under Stalin or Mao, their lives. Officials carrying out particular policies may be quite rational. However negative the impact of these policies may prove to be for society at large. During the Stalin era and the Soviet Union, for example, there was at one time a severe shortage of mining equipment, but the manager of a factory producing such machines kept them in storage after they were built, rather than sending them out to the mines, where they were sorely needed. The reason was that the official orders called for these machines to be painted with red, oil-resistant paint, and the manufacturer had on hand only green, oil-resistant paint and red varnish that was not oil-resistant. Nor could he readily get the prescribed paint, since there was no free market. Disobeying official orders in any respect was a serious offense under Stalin, and "I don't want to get 8 years," the manager said. When he explained the situation to a higher official and asked for permission to use the green oil-resistant paint, the official's response was, "Well, I don't want to get 8 years either." However, the higher official cabled to his ministry for their permission to give his permission. After a long delay, the ministry eventually granted his request, and the mining machinery was finally shipped to the mines. None of these people was behaving stupidly. They were responding quite rationally to the incentives and constraints of the system in which they worked. Under any economic or political system, people can make their choices only among the alternatives actually available, and different economic systems present different alternatives. Even in a democratic government, where the personal dangers would be far less, a highly intelligent person with a record of outstanding success in the private sector is often unable to repeat that success when appointed to a high position in government. Again, the point is that the incentives and constraints are different in different institutions. As Nobel Prize-winning economist George J. Stigler put it, "A large number of successful businessmen have gone on to high administrative posts in the national government, and many, I think most, have been less than distinguished successes in that new environment. They are surrounded and overpowered by informed and entrenched subordinates. They must deal with legislators who can be relentless in their demands, and almost everything in their agency that should be changed is untouchable." Incentives versus goals. Incentives matter because most people will usually do more for their own benefit than for the benefit of others. Incentives link the two concerns together. A waitress brings food to your table, not because of your hunger, but because her salary and tips depend on it. In the absence of such incentives, service in restaurants in the Soviet Union was notoriously bad. Unsold goods piling up in warehouses were not the only consequences of a lack of the incentives that come with a free market price system. Prices not only help determine which particular things are produced, they are also one of the ways of rationing the inherent scarcity of all goods and services, as well as rationing the scarce resources that go into producing those goods and services. However, prices do not create that scarcity, which will require some form of rationing under any other economic system. Simple as all this may seem, it goes counter to many policies and programs designed to make various goods and services affordable or to keep them from becoming prohibitively expensive. But being prohibitive is precisely how prices limit how much each person uses. If everything were made affordable by government decree, there would still not be any more to go around than when things were prohibitively expensive. There would simply have to be some alternative method of rationing the inherent scarcity. Whether that method was through the governments issuing ration coupons, the emergence of black markets, or just fighting over things when they go on sale, the rationing would still have to be done, since artificially making things affordable does not create any more total output. On the contrary, price ceilings tend to cause less output to be produced. Many apparently humanitarian policies have backfired throughout history because of a failure to understand the role of prices. Attempts to keep food prices down by imposing price controls have led to hunger and even starvation, whether in 17th century Italy, 18th century India, France after the French Revolution, Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, or in a number of African countries after they obtained independence during the 1960s. Some of these African countries, like some of the countries in Eastern Europe, once had such an abundance of food that they were food exporters before the era of price control and government planning turned them into countries unable to feed themselves. Failure to supply goods as a result of government restrictions must be sharply distinguished from an inability to produce them. Food can be in short supply in a country with extraordinarily fertile soil, as in post-communist Russia that had not yet achieved a free market economy. Undulating gently through pastoral hills 150 miles south of Moscow, the Plava River Valley is a farmer's dream come true. This is the gateway to what Russians call Chernozem, Black Earth Country, which boasts some of the most fertile soil in Europe, within 3 hours' drive of a giant, hungry metropolis. Black Earth Country has the natural wealth to feed an entire nation, but it can barely feed itself. It is hard even to imagine, in a free market economy, a hungry city dependent on imports of foreign food when there is extraordinarily fertile farmland not far away. Yet the people on that very fertile farmland were as poor as the city dwellers were hungry. The workers harvesting that land earned the equivalent of about $10 a week, with even this small amount being paid in kind, sacks of potatoes or cucumbers, because of a lack of money. As the mayor of a town in this region said, "We ought to be rich. We have wonderful soil. We have the scientific know-how. We have qualified people. But what does it add up to?" If nothing else, it adds up to a reason for understanding economics as a means of achieving an efficient allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. All that was lacking in Russia was a market to connect the hungry city with the products of the fertile land, and a government that would allow such a market to function freely. But in some places, local Russian officials forbade the movement of food across local boundary lines in order to assure low food prices within their own jurisdictions, and therefore local political support for themselves. Again, it is necessary to emphasize that this was not a stupid policy from the standpoint of officials trying to gain local popularity with consumers by maintaining low food prices. This protected their political careers, however disastrous such policies were for the country as a whole. While systemic causation in a free market is in one sense impersonal, in the sense that its outcomes are not specifically predetermined by any given person, the market is ultimately a way by which many people's individual personal desires are reconciled with those of other people. Too often, a false contrast is made between the impersonal marketplace and the supposedly compassionate policies of various government programs. But both systems face the same scarcity of resources, and both systems make choices within the constraints of that scarcity. The difference is that one system involves each individual making choices for himself or herself, while the other system involves a small number of people making choices for millions of others. The mechanisms of the market are impersonal, but the choices made by individuals are as personal as choices made anywhere else. It may be fashionable for journalists to refer to the whim of the marketplace as if that were something different from the desires of people, just as it was once fashionable to advocate production for use rather than profit, as if profits could be made by producing things that people cannot use or do not want to use. The real contrast is between choices made by individuals for themselves and choices made for them by others, who presume to define what these individuals really need. Scarcity and competition. Scarcity means that everyone's desires cannot be satisfied completely, regardless of which particular economic system or government policy we choose, and regardless of whether an individual or a society is poor or prosperous, wise or foolish, noble or ignoble. Competition among people for scarce resources is inherent. It is not a question whether we like or dislike competition. Scarcity means that we do not have the option to choose whether or not to have an economy in which people compete. That is the only kind of economy that is possible, and our only choice is among the particular methods that can be used for that competition. Economic institutions. Most people may be unaware that they are competing when making purchases, and simply see themselves as deciding how much of various things to buy at whatever prices they find. But scarcity ensures that they are competing with others, even if they are conscious only of weighing their own purchasing decisions against the amount of money they have available. One of the incidental benefits of competing and sharing through prices is that different people are not as likely to think of themselves as rivals, nor to develop the kinds of hostility that rivalry can breed. For example, much the same labor and construction material needed to build a Protestant church could be used to build a Catholic church. But if a Protestant congregation is raising money to build a church for themselves, they are likely to be preoccupied with how much money they can raise and how much is needed for the kind of church they want. Construction prices may cause them to scale back some of their more elaborate plans in order to fit within the limits of what they can afford. But they are unlikely to blame Catholics, even though the competition of Catholics for the same construction materials makes their prices higher than otherwise. If, instead, the government were in the business of building churches and giving them to different religious groups, Protestants and Catholics would be explicit rivals for this largesse, and neither would have any financial incentive to cut back on their building plans to accommodate the other. Instead, each would have an incentive to make the case, as strongly as possible, for the full extent of their desires, to mobilize their followers politically to insist on getting what they want, and to resent any suggestion that they scale back their plans. The inherent scarcity of materials and labor would still limit what could be built, but that limit would now be imposed politically and would be seen by each as due to the rivalry of the other. The Constitution of the United States, of course, prevents the American government from building churches for religious groups, no doubt in order to prevent just such political rivalries and the bitterness, and sometimes bloodshed, to which such rivalries have led in other countries and in other times. The same economic principle, however, applies to groups that are not based on religion, but on ethnicity, geographic regions, or age brackets. All are inherently competing for the same resources, simply because these resources are scarce. However, competing indirectly by having to keep your demands within the limits of your own pocketbook is very different from seeing your desires for government benefits thwarted directly by the rival claims of some other group. The self-rationing created by prices not only tends to mean less social and political friction, but also more economic efficiency, since each individual knows his or her own preferences better than any third party can, and can therefore make incremental trade-offs that are more personally satisfying within the limits of the available resources. Rationing through pricing also limits the amount of each individual's claims on the output of others to what that individual's own productivity has created for others, and thereby earned as income. What price controls, subsidies, or other substitutes for price allocation do is reduce the incentives for self-rationing. That is why people with minor ailments go to doctors when medical care is either free or heavily subsidized by the government, and why farmers receiving government-subsidized water from irrigation projects grow crops requiring huge amounts of water, which they would never grow if they had to pay the full costs of that water themselves. Society as a whole always has to pay the full costs, regardless of what prices are or are not charged to individuals. When price controls make goods artificially cheaper, that allows greater self-indulgence by some, which means that less is left for others. Thus, many apartments occupied by just one person under rent control means that others have trouble finding a place to stay, even when they are perfectly willing and able to pay the current rent. Moreover, since rationing must take place with or without prices, this means that some form of non-price rationing becomes a substitute. Simply waiting until what you want becomes available has been a common form of non-price rationing. This can mean waiting in long lines at stores, as was common in the Soviet economy, or being put on a waiting list for surgery, as patients often are in countries where government-provided medical care is either free or heavily subsidized. Luck and corruption are other substitutes for price rationing. Whoever happens to be in a store when a new shipment of some product in short supply arrives can get the first opportunity to buy it, while people who happen to learn about it much later can find the coveted product all gone by the time they get there. In other cases, personal or political favoritism or bribery takes the place of luck in gaining preferential access, or formal rationing systems may replace favoritism with some one-size-fits-all policy administered by government agencies. However it is done, the rationing that is done by prices in market economies cannot be gotten rid of by getting rid of prices, or by the government's lowering the level of prices. Incremental substitution. As important as it is to understand the role of substitutions, it is also important to keep in mind that the efficient allocation of resources requires that these substitutions be incremental, not total. For example, one may believe that health is more important than entertainment, but however reasonable that may sound as a general principle, no one really believes that having a 20-year supply of Band-Aids in the closet is more important than having to give up all music in order to pay for it. A price-coordinated economy facilitates incremental substitution, but political decision-making tends toward categorical priorities, that is, declaring one thing absolutely more important than another, and creating laws and policies accordingly. When some political figure says that we need to set national priorities about one thing or another, what that amounts to is making A categorically more important than B. This is the opposite of incremental substitution, in which the value of each depends on how much of each we already have at the moment, and therefore on the changing amount of A that we are willing to give up in order to get more B. This variation in the relative values of things can be so great as to convert something that is beneficial into something that is detrimental, or vice versa. For example, human beings cannot live without salt, fat, and cholesterol, but most Americans get so much of all three that their lifespan is reduced. Conversely, despite the many problems caused by alcohol, from fatal automobile accidents to deaths from cirrhosis of the liver, studies show that very modest amounts of alcohol have health benefits that can be life-saving. Alcohol is not categorically good or bad. Whenever there are two things which each have some value, one cannot be categorically more valuable than another. A diamond may be worth much more than a penny, but enough pennies will be worth more than any diamond. That is why incremental trade-offs tend to produce better results than categorical priorities. There are chronic complaints about government red tape in countries around the world, but the creation of red tape is understandable in view of the incentives facing those who create government forms, rules, and requirements for innumerable activities that require official approval. Nothing is easier than thinking of additional requirements that might be useful in some way or other, at some time or other, and nothing is harder than remembering to ask the crucial incremental question, at what cost? People who are spending their own money are confronted with those costs at every turn, but people who are spending the taxpayers' money, or who are simply imposing uncounted costs on businesses, homeowners, and others, have no real incentives to even find out how much the additional costs are, much less to hold off on adding requirements when the incremental costs threaten to become larger than the incremental benefits to those on whom these costs are imposed by the government. Red tape grows as a result. Any attempt to get rid of some of this red tape is likely to be countered by government officials, who can point out what useful purpose these requirements may serve in some circumstances. But they are unlikely even to pose the question whether the incremental benefit exceeds the incremental costs. There are no incentives for them to look at things that way, nor are the media likely to. A New York Times article, for example, argued that there were few, if any, useless regulations, as if that was the relevant criterion. But neither individuals nor businesses are willing or able to pay for everything that is not useless when they are spending their own money. No doubt there are reasons, or at least rationales, for the many government regulations imposed on businesses in Italy, for example, but the real question is whether their costs exceed their benefits. Imagine you're an ambitious Italian entrepreneur trying to make a go of a new business. You know you will have to pay at least two-thirds of your employees' Social Security costs. You also know you're going to run into problems once you hire your 16th employee, since that will trigger provisions, making it either impossible or very expensive to dismiss a staffer. But there's so much more. Once you hire employee 11, you must submit an annual self-assessment to the national authorities, outlining every possible health and safety hazard to which your employees might be subject. These include stress that is work-related or caused by age, gender, and racial differences. You must also note all precautionary and individual measures to prevent risks, procedures to carry them out, the names of employees in charge of safety, as well as the physician whose presence is required for the assessment. By the time your firm hires its 51st worker, 7% of the payroll must be handicapped in some way. Once you hire your 101st employee, you must submit a report every 2 years on the gender dynamics within the company. This must include a tabulation of the men and women employed in each production unit, their functions and level within the company, details of compensation and benefits, and dates and reasons for recruitments, promotions, and transfers, as well as the estimated revenue impact. As of the time that this description of Italian labor laws appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the unemployment rate in Italy was 10%, and the Italian economy was contracting rather than growing. Subsidies and taxes. Ideally, prices allow alternative users to compete for scarce resources in the marketplace. However, this competition is distorted to the extent that special taxes are put on some products or resources but not on others, or when some products or resources are subsidized by the government but others are not. Prices charged to the consumers of such specially taxed or specially subsidized goods and services do not convey the real costs of producing them, and therefore do not lead to the same trade-offs as if they did. Yet there is always a political temptation to subsidize good things and tax bad things. However, when neither good things nor bad things are good or bad categorically, this prevents our finding out just how good or bad any of these things is by letting people choose freely, uninfluenced by politically changed prices. People who want special taxes or subsidies for particular things seem not to understand that what they are really asking for is for the prices to misstate the relative scarcities of things and the relative values that the users of these things put on them. One of the factors in California's recurring water crises, for example, is that California farmers' use of water is subsidized heavily. Farmers in California's Imperial Valley pay $15 for the same amount of water that costs $400 in Los Angeles. The net result is that agriculture, which accounts for less than 2% of the state's output, consumes 43% of its water. California farmers grow crops requiring great amounts of water, such as rice and cotton, in a very dry climate, where such crops would never be grown if farmers had to pay the real costs of the water they use. Inspiring as it may be to some observers that California's arid lands have been enabled to produce vast amounts of fruits and vegetables with the aid of subsidized water, those same fruits and vegetables could be produced more cheaply elsewhere with water supplied free of charge from the clouds. The way to tell whether the California produce is worth what it costs to grow is to allow all those costs to be paid by California farmers who compete with farmers in other states that have higher rainfall levels. There is no need for government officials to decide arbitrarily and categorically whether it is a good thing or a bad thing for particular crops to be grown in California with water artificially supplied below cost from federal irrigation projects. Such questions can be decided incrementally by those directly confronting the alternatives through price competition in a free market. California is, unfortunately, not unique in this respect. In fact, this is not a peculiarly American problem. Halfway around the world, the government of India provides almost free electricity and water to farmers, according to The Economist magazine, encouraging farmers to plant too much water-guzzling rice, with the result that water tables in the Punjab are dropping fast. Making anything artificially cheap usually means that it will be wasted, whatever that thing might be and wherever it might be located. From the standpoint of the allocation of resources, government should either not tax resources, goods, and services, or else tax them all equally, so as to minimize the distortions of choices made by consumers and producers. For similar reasons, particular resources, goods, and services should not be subsidized, even if particular people are subsidized out of humanitarian concern over their being the victims of natural disasters, birth defects, or other misfortunes beyond their control. Giving poor people money would accomplish the same humanitarian purpose without the same distortion in the allocation of resources created by subsidizing or taxing different products differently. However much economic efficiency would be promoted by letting resource prices be unchanged by taxes or subsidies, from a political standpoint, politicians win votes by doing special favors for special interests or putting special taxes on whomever or whatever might be unpopular at the moment. The free market may work best when there is a level playing field, but politicians win more votes by tilting the playing field to favor particular groups. Often this process is rationalized politically in terms of a need to help the less fortunate, but once the power and the practice are established, they provide the means of subsidizing all sorts of groups who are not the least bit unfortunate. For example, the Wall Street Journal reported, "A chunk of the federal taxes and fees paid by airline passengers are awarded to small airports used mainly by private pilots and globe-trotting corporate executives." The meaning of costs. Sometimes the rationale for removing particular things from the process of weighing costs against benefits is expressed in some such question as, "How can you put a price on art, or education, health, music, etc.?" The fundamental fallacy underlying this question is the belief that prices are simply put on things. So long as art, education, health, music, and thousands of other things all require time, effort, and raw material, the costs of these inputs are inherent. These costs do not go away because a law prevents them from being conveyed through prices in the marketplace. Ultimately, to society as a whole, costs are the other things that could have been produced with the same resources. Money flows, and price movements are symptoms of that fact, and suppressing those symptoms will not change the underlying fact. One reason for the popularity of price controls is a confusion between prices and costs. For example, politicians who say that they will bring down the cost of medical care almost invariably mean that they will bring down the prices paid for medical care. The actual costs of medical care, the years of training for doctors, the resources used in building and equipping hospitals, the hundreds of millions of dollars for years of research to develop a single new medication, are unlikely to decline in the slightest. Nor are these things even likely to be addressed by politicians. What politicians mean by bringing down the cost of medical care is reducing the price of medicines and reducing the fees charged by doctors or hospitals. Once the distinction between prices and costs is recognized, then it is not very surprising that price controls have the negative consequences that they do, because price ceilings mean a refusal to pay the full costs. Those who supply housing, food, medications, or innumerable other goods and services are unlikely to keep on supplying them in the same quantities and qualities when they cannot recover the costs that such quantities and qualities require. This may not become apparent immediately, which is why price controls are often popular, but the consequences are lasting and often become worse over time. Housing does not disappear immediately when there is rent control, but it deteriorates over time without being replaced by sufficient new housing as it wears out. Existing medicines do not necessarily vanish under price controls, but new medicines to deal with cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's, and numerous other afflictions are unlikely to continue to be developed at the same pace when the money to pay for the costs and risks of creating new medications is just not there anymore. But all this takes time to unfold, and memories may be too short for most people to connect the bad consequences they experience to the popular policies they supported some years back. Despite how obvious all this might seem, there are never-ending streams of political schemes designed to escape the realities being conveyed by prices, whether through direct price controls, or by making this or that affordable with subsidies, or by having the government itself supply various goods and services free, as a right. There may be more ill-conceived economic policies based on treating prices as just nuisances to get around than on any other single fallacy. What all these schemes have in common is that they exempt some things from the process of weighing costs and benefits against one another, a process essential to maximizing the benefits from scarce resources which have alternative uses. The most valuable economic role of prices is in conveying information about an underlying reality, while at the same time providing incentives to respond to that reality. Prices, in a sense, can summarize the end results of a complex reality in a simple number. For example, a photographer who wants to buy a telephoto lens may confront a choice between two lenses that produce images of equal quality and with the same magnification, but one of which emits twice as much light as the other. This second lens can take pictures in dimmer light, but there are optical problems created by a wider lens opening that admits more light. While the photographer may be wholly unaware of these optical problems, their solution can require a more complex lens made of more expensive glass. What the photographer is made aware of is that the lens with the wider opening has a higher price. The only decision to be made by the photographer is whether the higher price is worth it for the particular kinds of pictures he takes. A landscape photographer who takes pictures outdoors on sunny days may find the higher-priced lens not worth the extra money, while a photographer who takes pictures indoors in museums that do not permit flashes to be used may have no choice but to pay more for the lens with the wider opening. Because knowledge is one of the scarcest of all resources, prices play an important role in economizing on the amount of knowledge required for decision-making by any given individual or organization. The photographer needs no knowledge of the science of optics in order to make an efficient trade-off when choosing among lenses, while the lens designer, who knows optics, need have no knowledge of the rules of museums or the market for photographs taken in museums and in other places with limited amounts of light. In a different economic system which does not rely on prices, but relies instead on a given official or a planning commission to make decisions about the use of scarce resources, a vast amount of knowledge of the various complex factors behind even a relatively simple decision, like producing and using a camera lens, would be required in order to make an efficient use of scarce resources which have alternative uses. After all, glass is used not only in camera lenses, but also in microscopes, telescopes, windows, mirrors, and innumerable other things. To know how much glass should be allocated to the production of each of these many products would require more expertise in more complex subjects than any individual or any manageable-sized group can be expected to master. Although the 20th century began with many individuals and groups looking forward to a time when price-coordinated economies would be replaced by centrally planned economies, the rise and fall of centrally planned economies took place over several decades. By the end of the 20th century, even most socialist and communist governments around the world had returned to the use of prices to coordinate their economies. However attractive central planning may have seemed before it was tried, concrete experience led even its advocates to rely more and more on price-coordinated markets. An international study of free markets in 2012 found the world's freest market to be in Hong Kong, in a country with a communist government.